It is Friday, August 18th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, as the debate over Confederate statues in the United States continues, a Baltimore historian talks about his city's monuments.
The idea was basically to honor these people and show the part of Baltimore history that the city was in fact divided.
Residents of North America prepare for next week's eclipse, and the co-author of singer Glen Campbell's autobiography shares his memories of the musician. It's all ahead. The events in Charlottesville, Virginia last weekend, which left three people dead, reignited a long-simmering debate about Confederate statues in the United States. Many people are demanding their removal, but others are arguing history should not be erased. The Charlottesville protests centered around Emancipation Park, where there's a statue honoring Confederate General Robert E. Lee, who commanded Southern troops in America's Civil War in the 1860s. White supremacists say the reason they wanted to hold their rally in that park was to protest efforts to take the statue down. On Thursday, U.S. President Donald Trump spoke out against the removal of the statues. In a string of Twitter comments, Trump said it was sad to see the history and culture of our great country being ripped apart with the removal of our beautiful statues and monuments. According to Slate magazine, there are about 13,000 Confederate statues and other commemorative items around the U.S., and they're not only in the former Confederacy. Earlier this week, the city of Baltimore, Maryland, removed four Confederate monuments during the night. Two of them honored Lee and fellow Confederate General Stonewall Jackson, and Roger Taney, the Supreme Court Justice who wrote the 1857 Dred Scott decision that denied citizenship to African Americans and upheld slavery. Wayne Schomburg is a Baltimore historian who leads tours around the city's historic sites. He spoke to me about the Baltimore monuments.
The four monuments, one honoring Roger Taney, one honoring Confederate women who volunteered in the war. Then there's a monument honoring Lee and Jackson. And then finally, a monument honoring Confederate soldiers and sailors. All fit into the history of Baltimore. Baltimore's an interesting town at the time of the Civil War. It was very divided. In fact, probably more Confederate-leaning than it was Union-leaning. And the great example I always give when I talk to my students is, in the election of 1860, 91,000 votes were cast in Maryland. Lincoln got 2,000 of them. He finished absolutely dead last in the election. So the city is a divided city. And the first bloodshed of the Civil War took place in Baltimore in a riot on Pratt Street a week after Fort Sumter. The Lee Jackson Monument, which is one of the more interesting ones, was actually a gift from a Baltimore banker in the 1920s who left behind money to have Lee and Jackson monument put up because they were his boyhood heroes of the Civil War. Again, all of them were done here in the 1920s, except for Taney. His monument was done in the 1870s. But the idea was basically to honor these people and show the part of Baltimore history that the city was, in fact, divided.
Well, now, I don't think Maryland did not secede from the Union, did it?
No, we were a slave state, and we stayed in the Union, and basically, the truth be known is we would have been forced to stay in the Union had we not decided to. And that was once the war began, Virginia seceded from the Union. So the United States Capitol was on the border with the Confederacy, and Lincoln made sure that Maryland did not leave. At the beginning of the war, Lincoln occupied Baltimore with troops for the rest of the Civil War. We were an occupied city.
Now, a number of historians have pointed out, like you were saying, that some of these Confederate, or many of these Confederate statues and monuments were actually erected in the 20s. You know, they weren't done sort of after the war. And, you know, I think it was also at that time, wasn't the Ku Klux Klan gaining in popularity?
The revival of the Klan. When you think of the 1920s, I remember a famous picture in the textbook I used with my high school classes, the famous Klan march down the street to Washington, D.C., and I don't know, it was the mid-20s. And also the other thing that goes in with that is the development of Jim Crow. Jim Crow now is, you know, Jim Crow comes along with Plessy versus Ferguson in 1896, and now that's going strong as well. So it's kind of this three thing. You're right, the rival of the Klan, Jim Crow, and these monuments that are now to glorify the Confederacy and the so-called lost cause of the Civil War.
Have you been by the monuments since they were removed?
No, I haven't, but I teach a course on monuments in Baltimore, so I've been by them many times and have taken people on tours around the city for the monuments, and I always do at least two of the Civil War monuments because of the fact of what they are and the fact that they some of them have very neat stories behind them. And I've never really thought about it until this has come along, that the African Americans in this country, especially in cities in the South where a lot of these monuments are, you know, have to walk by these monuments. They raise an aspect of their history which they very much are not happy with.
Baltimore historian Wayne Schomburg. Well, joining me here in the studio is social media editor Andrew Pelshevsky. So, Andrew, I know there's a big news story breaking.
Yes, big breaking news on social media right now. Steve Bannon, President Trump's senior strategist, is reportedly out at the White House. One of the more controversial figures in the Trump administration had been accused of expressing racist views in the past. And now the word coming out that he is no longer going to be an advisor to President Trump. Unclear if he was fired or resigned and what perhaps the new chief of staff, John Kelly, had to do with this. There was talk when he came on that he was going to kind of clean house in the Trump administration. Also unclear as to when this happened. Some on social media are saying that he was actually ousted as many as a couple weeks ago and just been kind of hanging on and lingering until the announcement today. But this information is swirling very rapidly, and with that, a lot of speculation about other figures in the Trump administration. Two names in particular, advisors Steve Miller and Sebastian Gorka. There are two other controversial figures who have had views that have been deemed racist or discriminatory. So people wondering if this is a house cleaning in the White House, if those two will be going as well. So we'll have to continue to monitor that. But again, the big breaking news, Steve Bannon out as senior advisor to President Trump. Another person that's trending today, Tina Fey, the comedian. She appeared on Saturday Night Live's Weekend Update yesterday. They did a kind of a summer edition of Saturday Night Live on Thursday night to talk about the racial tensions at her alma mater, the University of Virginia, located in Charlottesville. And she took these white supremacist and Nazi sympathizers to task, but also told people to stay at home and eat cake instead of confronting them. She said confronting them and creating more hate isn't going to do any good, so she called it sheet caking. She said get a cake, stay home and eat the cake and try to, you know, think about positive things, I guess. So some people saying the advice is great, that she took these people to task was great. There are other people, however, saying that her views are kind of naive, especially for someone who maybe hasn't had to fight for their rights as someone who's white, saying that the real fight is going to happen on these front lines and people shouldn't stay home. They should go out and confront these people. Then the other people say that's a misunderstanding. So it's a back and forth. But the video that she did, a little 6-minute segment on Saturday Night Live going viral, I've seen it on multiple social media platforms as people watch that. A little bit of humor in the midst of the turmoil that we're seeing here in the United States.
Yeah, a lot of turmoil. All right. Thanks very much, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Pelshevsky. Here are some of the top news stories trending. Former Republican presidential nominee Mitt Romney criticizes President Trump for his handling of the Charlottesville protests. In Finland, one person is dead and 8 people are injured in a stabbing there. Spanish police make a 4th arrest following multiple terror attacks, and President Trump and his security team will mull strategic options on Afghanistan. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOAnews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Millions of students are now either starting or returning to colleges and universities around the world. In the U.S. and in Canada, freshman 15 is a popular expression that refers to an estimated 15 pounds or 7 kilograms of weight freshmen are said to gain during their first year of college. According to the University of Texas at Austin website, some of the reasons for this weight gain may be due to erratic sleeping and eating patterns and the pressures of college leading to stress eating. Now a new study from Drexel University and University of Pennsylvania researchers provides a possible method for avoiding the infamous freshman 15. The researchers found that female college-aged students who weighed themselves daily saw their body mass index, or BMI, drop. Those who didn't weigh themselves each day saw no such reduction. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, a Nashville writer remembers the late singer Glen Campbell. Much of North America will experience a total or partial solar eclipse Monday. A total eclipse is something Americans haven't seen in nearly a century. Observers will be able to watch the moon completely cover the sun across a 113-kilometer-wide path of the U.S. mainland from South Carolina on the Atlantic coast to Oregon in the Pacific Northwest, covering parts of 14 states. It's a lifetime experience not to be missed, according to U.S. Space Agency NASA scientist Michelle Thaler.
There's an eclipse of the sun that's going to go all the way across the United States, and that hasn't happened for 99 years. So the moon is actually going to move in front of the sun and cast a shadow down on the Earth. I mean, it's really quite simple. And that shadow will be about a 70-mile strip of total darkness that'll go across the United States. But even if you're not in that narrow strip, everyone in the United States is going to see a partial eclipse at least.
NASA is offering a smartphone app called the Globe Observer so people can participate in an experiment using an inexpensive thermometer, since the temperature will drop and the darkness may change cloud patterns. Optometrist B. Ralph Chu, professor emeritus at the University of Waterloo in Ontario, Canada, also an accomplished astronomer, tells International Edition's Victor Beatty, while this is his 19th eclipse, each one is unique.
Even after seeing 18 total eclipses in my lifetime, it's still hard to predict how it's going to appear on the big day. But, you know, certainly one of the things that all of us eclipse chasers are going to be looking for is the appearance of the outer atmosphere of the sun, the corona, because unless you have specialized telescope equipment, you cannot see the corona normally outside of a total solar eclipse. So the appearance of the outer atmosphere of the sun is really something that's very attractive to us. You know, until the moon extinguishes the bright disk of the sun for that couple of minutes during total eclipse, we can only sort of guess at what it might look like. But whatever it's going to be really spectacular.
More than just a natural phenomenon, then, there is scientific value to this.
Oh, absolutely. You know, one of the things that we forget is that there are still uncertainties in our knowledge about the orbit of the Earth around the sun and the orbit of the moon around the Earth. And solar eclipses help us to find out about the precision of our knowledge of those orbital mechanics. The other thing is that by studying the corona, scientists are able to get a better understanding of how the magnetic fields of the sun react to activity at the surface of the sun. And this is really important because we actually are affected here on Earth by the activity of the corona.
Aside from the scientific value and the natural phenomena that most people are looking forward to, looking at the solar eclipse with the naked eye can be dangerous.
In fact, it's one of the things that I study as a scientist. And yes, it is very true that if you look at the sun without proper protection, you do run a substantial risk of damaging the back of your eyes.
Are there new safety glasses out there today that weren't available decades ago that people can purchase and use?
Yes, absolutely. And in fact, that's why we think that this could become one of the most widely observed eclipses in modern history, because there are very inexpensive solar eclipse glasses and viewers available to the public. They are being sold by many outlets, including science museums, telescope shops. You can actually find them in some giveaways by certain merchants. They are bound into some copies of astronomical magazines. And on eclipse day across the U.S., The public libraries will be giving out free solar viewers to people attending their solar eclipse parties throughout the day.
B. Ralph Chu, Professor Emeritus at the University of Waterloo in Canada. The American Astronomical Society has put out a list on its website of reputable vendors of solar filters and viewers to avoid damaging your retina. If weather blocks your view, the next North American total solar eclipse can be seen in April 2024. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
This is International Edition. Last week, singer Glen Campbell died at the age of 81 following a long struggle with Alzheimer's disease. Tom Carter helped Campbell write his autobiography, published in 1994. I spoke with the Nashville-based Carter about Campbell's life, which began in poverty in the tiny rural community of Billstown, Arkansas.
Glen was taught how to play guitar by his uncle. And so the uncle bought a guitar for young Glenn, who was about six. He ordered the instrument from Sears and Roebuck Company, and his uncle taught him a few chords, and Glenn took it from there. Glenn just had natural talent. So he moved when he was like 21 or something to go to California, and he was going to try to get session work, and he did. And here he was, he couldn't read music, couldn't write music, but he was a first chair lead guitarist, and he played on number one songs by Frank Sinatra and Tony Bennett and the Beach Boys. He played on a lot of those rock and roll as well as middle of the road kingpins.
So how did he go from being, he was a very successful session musician, as you said, but how did he go from that to becoming his own solo act?
The Smother Brothers, a comedy act, had a primetime show on CBS. And in those days, if you had a primetime show and the show was a hit, then CBS would let you off for the summer. And CBS Big Shot said to the Smothers Brothers, "Do you know anybody who could pitch in for you guys for about 12 weeks when you're on hiatus? And, you know, can we get someone to host your show?" Long story short, they had met Glenn because he had played behind their comedy records. And they said, "Look, would you do this for us for a favor just for 12 weeks? He said, "Okay." And they thought he would just play guitar, which he did. But they didn't know he sang. And when he sang, he had the guitar, he had a voice that was like a bell, and he had the looks like the all-American boy who everybody wants to live next door. And he hit. He was an overnight sensation. And then, of course, Glenn's recording career cooled. But then along came Rhinestone Cowboy, and it regenerated his musical career.
Now, though, during this time, he had some problems in his personal life. I mean, he went through some divorces. He had, a pretty famous relationship with Tanya Tucker, and he also had some drug and alcohol problems.
That's correct. It's in his book. He was a madman. I mean, you nailed it. He was a disgusting alcoholic. and somebody gave him some cocaine, and he would stay up for 5 and 6 days at a time. And his shows were suffering. But he had a spiritual experience. He had been reared in a fundamentalist church when he was a lad, and he turned back to that. He really underwent a transformation. He didn't drink. He didn't go back to booze or cocaine for probably 15 years. He did have a relapse with the alcohol, but I don't think he ever touched the cocaine again. You know, he was the triumph of the human spirit. One kid who grows up in poverty, that, like somewhere in Appalachia, and he works his way out of all of that, and then he gets an A-list chair as a recording guitarist, and he becomes a national phenomenon, and he makes all this money, and then he the booze and the wives and the cocaine, and he goes through that. Four wives at plus Tanya, plus women who would, a different woman every night, and he whipped all of that. And he was doing fine for more than a decade, and then for almost 2 decades, and then bam, he was clobbered with Alzheimer's.
I am a lineman for the county, and I drive the main road, searching in the sun for another overload. I hear you singing.
Singer Glenn Campbell, who was buried in his Arkansas hometown the day after his death. Well, that's our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Have a great weekend.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Vice President Mike Pence had an important message to deliver to the people of Colombia on his recent visit. The United States stands with Colombia because our security and our prosperity are inextricably linked. Our interests are aligned, our values are the same, and the birthright of freedom belongs to both our people. The Colombian government and the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, or FARC, last year signed an agreement that ended the longest-running conflict in the Western Hemisphere. Colombia now faces the challenge of consolidating that peace. The greatest risk to that peace, said Vice President Pence, is the absence of infrastructure, basic services, the rule of law in war-affected areas that's creating a haven for criminal activities, drugs, and violence. The United States will continue to partner with Colombia to address these issues. This year marks the sixth year of the U.S.-Colombia Trade Promotion Agreement, an agreement that has created jobs and opportunities in both nations. Colombia is the United States' third-largest trading partner in Latin America, with a two-way goods trade of nearly $27 billion in 2016 alone. The United States supports Colombia's aspirations to join the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development. In demonstration of this support, the United States announced it will provide Colombia up to $2 million in technical assistance to achieve that objective. In spite of all this progress, our greatest concern, said Mr. Pence, is the dramatic increase in cocaine production, which has now reached an all-time high in Colombia. This worsening crisis requires swift action to protect the people of both our countries. The drug trade is a source of violence, crime, and corruption, and victimizes the Colombian people. And in the United States, illegal drugs have poisoned children, torn apart families, and devastated many communities. The United States will continue to address its demand for illegal drugs with border security, internal enforcement, and a renewed effort to remove dangerous criminals, gang members, and drug dealers from the streets of the United States. Colombia, said Vice President Pence, represents the future of Latin America. It is a future of freedom, security, and prosperity. And America stands with you.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.